This is Talk is Cheap on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Also streaming online at KEPW.org, where you can donate if you want. All right, so what this is from last year's crime report, thecrimereport.com, or .org, is the Guggenheim Symposium in March of 2021 on progressive prosecutors. Can progressive prosecutors make a difference? Part 1. Hosted by Marissa Bluestein from the Center for Fair Administration of Justice, featuring John Chisholm, District Attorney of Milwaukee, Miriam Krinsky of Fair and Just Prosecution, San Francisco District Attorney Chasia Bowden, and a public defender named Darcy Calvert. All right, so that's coming up here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends.
So, Marissa, it's over to you. You have four.
So, Stephen, if that's an issue, please feel free to interrupt so that we can get to Mr. Boudin's questions. So, I'm sure folks have questions for him indeed. So, thank you so much, Stephen and John Jay, for welcoming us, and particularly me. My name is Marissa Bluestein. I am with the Quattrone Center for the Fair Administration of Justice at the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School, and I'm very excited to be a part of this panel discussion. I just want to set the table a bit before we start. We're here to talk about the progressive prosecutor agenda, of course. More specifically, really, what is a progressive prosecutor? How have progressive criminal justice reforms taken hold? How have they, where does the criminal justice reform go from here? So as early as 1940, Attorney General Robert Jackson famously wrote that the prosecutor has more control over life, liberty, and reputation than any other person in America. And the criminal legal system has vested extraordinary control and power in the prosecutor with broad and frankly unchecked discretion. From charging to discovery provision to plea bargaining, prosecutors drive decisions within the system like no other player. But over the past decade or so, we've seen major sectors of our society question that presumption and that are pushing the idea that a prosecutor can actually be a force for change and for good. Discretion can be used to promote power, but it can also be used to diffuse power. As this movement grows and gains legitimacy, we start to see a difference between a progressive who prosecutes and a progressive prosecutor. So we've seen some strong pushback from stakeholders against some of the reforms that have been pushed by prosecutors and judges denying agreed upon motions for post-conviction relief, strong issues of, pushing back again, as I said, for post-conviction relief and resentencing, law enforcement, of course, being very active against some of these reforms, even legislators working to undermine some of the reform measures. So as the movement grows and moves forward, questions are rising on whether prosecutors are even qualified or able to play the role in reducing mass incarceration that we hope they can. Professor Abby Smith, in fact, 20 years ago, asked the question, can a good person be a good prosecutor? So today we're going to look deeply into those issues surrounding this movement from people who are deeply involved. John Chisholm has been the elected district attorney in Milwaukee, Wisconsin since 2007. Mr. Chisholm has spearheaded changes in his office that have been duplicated by other offices in the country in areas such as evidence-based investigations, reducing reliance on incarceration, and increased community involvement. Miriam Krinsky is a former federal prosecutor and the director of Fair and Just Prosecution, an organization dedicated to supporting elected prosecutors with information sharing and resource materials, and promoting a collaborative approach to criminal justice reform. Darcy Covert is a state public defender currently serving in Seattle after beginning her career in San Francisco. Ms. Covert conducts research in the areas of prosecutorial discretion and decision-making and recently published a provocative article questioning the viability of the progressive prosecutor movement. And finally, Chesa Boudin is the newly elected district attorney of San Francisco. A career public defender, Mr. Boudin was elected to office on a platform centered on decarceration and even ending cash bail. Since taking office, Mr. Boudin has pursued an aggressive agenda to bring transparency to the office with a focus on ending racist practices in criminal investigations and prosecution. So each of our panelists will give a brief introduction explaining what they think about the progressive prosecutor movement and their own role in that. Then we'll move through a few questions about the history of the progressive prosecutor movement, what prosecutors who self-identify as progressive have accomplished, and then how the traditional system has responded or pushed back against some of those accomplishments. But finally, of course, we'll leave a good amount of time for your questions, which you can put up through the Q&A and we'll be moderating. So for our panelists, welcome. Thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us. And I want to start with you, Mr. Chisholm. What does it mean to be a progressive prosecutor to you?
Well, thank you very much, Marissa. It's great to be with John Jay University again, or John Jay College. And I'm glad you started where you started with Justice Jackson, right? So if you were to look at very general movements in criminal justice, that's as good a place to start as any. And I would say throughout the 40s and 50s, there was sort of what I would describe as the model criminal code movement, which basically tried to take the pre-existing laws that existed in separate jurisdictions and assign some rationality to them. And in Wisconsin, that was that was the signature of Frank Remington with the model penal code and efforts to make substantive law, administrative law, much more rational is really what it came down to. Sort of the next phase of the evolution of that I perceive the prosecutors have played a major role in was really more of an efficiency model than anything else. In other words, the idea was that all the problems that were occurring in your community could somehow be resolved if you had an efficient process of having the police arrest and intervene in those problems, and then prosecutors make a determination whether they thought the violation rose to the level of a criminal offense, and then you were just off to the races from that point on. Obviously, in retrospect, what we've seen is that right around that time, you had a major ballooning of the footprint of the criminal justice system and a massive sort of unprecedented expansion of incarceration that continues to this day. So I would say, within the last 10 years, you're starting to move into another epic of how prosecutors perceive their role. And I would, again, these are not academic terms, they're more experiential, and that would be that I think that prosecutors that have particularly, I started this, working since about 1993 as a prosecutor. And, at some point in time, you start questioning whether you're achieving the result that you want to achieve, which is you want your community to be safe. And you're just starting to ask if some of the processes that you're engaging in are achieving that result. So by about 2006, when I first ran for office, one of the first things I committed to, and of course I didn't call myself a progressive, that just wasn't a term used, but I recognized that there were serious issues in my community that correlated to race, to poverty, to concentrated disadvantage and violence and all of those issues. And I just made a commitment that I would start looking at it as objectively as I could and try to change what I could control, try to change the things that I was doing so that it would actually impact in a positive way in the community. And I think that's the heart of the progressive movement, if that's what you want to call it. I think it's just a fundamental commitment that prosecutors have that says the actions we take have broader consequences than just within the system itself, that what we do can actually impact the community for good or for bad. And so that's the that's really how I approached it, and started off by inviting an outside institution, the Beer Institute, to come in and take a look at whether our charging decisions were resulting in disparate outcomes for different people in our community, particularly based on the color of their skin. So that took me sort of down the path of trying to identify problems, contextualize them on whether they were impacting on different parts of our community differently, and then trying to change it. And like I said, from that point on, it's just been engaging and really thoughtful and challenging engagement from like-minded people that are trying to do the same thing. And the final thing I'd say is there, you know, it's not like you're given a membership card in the progressive movement. I mean, maybe Miriam is, I don't know, but I haven't gotten one. I don't have like miles or anything like that associated with it. But what it really is, and so it varies, right? People committed to that fundamental principle of trying to make their community better by using the authority, the responsibility that we have in a way that actually makes a difference and isn't just running people through the assembly line. I think that's the core of what a progressive prosecutor is. It's just tying what we do to trying to improve the outcomes in the communities of the people we serve. That's how I would view it.
Thank you, Mr. Chisholm. So I'm going to ask Chase Boudin from San Francisco. Same question. What does it mean to be a progressive prosecutor to you?
Thanks, Marissa, and thank you all for bringing us together. It's great to be on this panel and to see colleagues, friends, and think about a concept and a term that I think has become really watered down. And certainly in the race that I ran in 2019 to be San Francisco District Attorney, it was a four-way race, and all the candidates identified as Democrats, and all of them tried to claim the mantle of progressive prosecutor because the term is in vogue and San Francisco is a progressive town. And so there was a lot of conversation and I think effort to distinguish ourselves in a way that was more than just Democrat or Republican, progressive or traditional. Everyone wanted in my race to be a progressive prosecutor. And I think my friend and former Queens District Attorney candidate Tiffany Caban said it best during her campaign for Queens District Attorney when she said, it's not about being progressive or conservative, it's about being decarceral. And if you really want to identify as a progressive prosecutor, in my view, you have to be committed to a vision of public safety that involves moving away from a reliance on incarceration as a primary response or solution to the wide array of social problems that have been dumped on the criminal legal system for decades. So that's what we've tried to do in San Francisco since I took office. We've decreased our county jail population by about 40% in my first year. We decreased the number of people in state prison out of San Francisco by about a third in my first year. And of course, the COVID pandemic has shaped a lot of these numbers and a lot of the challenges that we faced. But I think that's a core part of what it means, in my view, to be a progressive prosecutor. It also means recognizing the history of racial bias and racial discrimination in this country, going all the way back to slavery, and understanding, as Michelle Alexander and Angela Davis and others have so eloquently written about, the connection between the history of slavery and Jim Crow and mass incarceration today, the ways in which our criminalization of so many different kinds of conduct, and including possession of small quantities of organic plant material, have led to the destruction of Black and brown communities in ways that in many instances were quite intentional and were developed by policymakers as a way to continue to hold down communities that could trace their oppression all the way back to slavery. When I ran for district attorney, I ran on a platform committed to ending mass incarceration because I knew from my own firsthand personal experience visiting both of my biological parents behind bars my entire life, that mass incarceration makes us less safe. It often treats victims as nothing more than pieces of evidence in a quest to secure convictions and prison sentences. It is disinterested in meaningful accountability, preferring to focus on punitive punishment. And it also is disinterested in rehabilitation. It doesn't care about successful reentry or about healing the harm that crime causes in communities. And so progressive prosecutors also have to center and empower victims in ways that are deeper and more complex than simply giving voice to our most retributive kind of cultural tendencies. And it also means, to give you another example of what it means to be a progressive prosecutor, it means enforcing the law equally, without regard to race or how much money we have in our bank account or whether we wear a uniform to work. It means holding police accountable. It means holding landlords and corporations that steal from workers accountable. It's why I started about a year ago now, a economic crimes against workers unit that filed a groundbreaking lawsuit against a gig economy company that was systematically and intentionally violating state law and misclassifying employees as workers, and in the process, stealing wages, stealing benefits, unfairly competing with other corporations in the same marketplace, and also harming all of us as taxpayers by depriving worker compensation funds and unemployment funds in Sacramento of the resources they needed to pay out benefits when the pandemic started. Those are the kinds of things that progressive prosecutors need to do. We need to balance public safety and compassion, not just for the people harmed by crime, but also for those we're prosecuting and for their families. We need to remember that the people we prosecute today are often the victims of a crime tomorrow. Crimes occur largely in the same communities. And so we are, in many, many thousands of cases, literally prosecuting someone who is also receiving victim services from our office or our community-based shareholders. So we need to break down this false dichotomy that is so often portrayed in the media saying there are sort of good people who are crime victims and there are bad people who are criminals. That's not how the world works. And we need to remember that every single case number, every single criminal charge involves real people, real lives, real families, real communities. And that until we break the cycle of incarceration and trauma, we will continue to live in cities and neighborhoods that are impacted by crime. I'm happy to talk more in questions about some of the things we've done, but let me just emphasize, we have filed the first ever homicide charges against an on-duty San Francisco police officer who killed an unarmed black man. We also filed charges against two other police officers for attacks on unarmed black men. Just yesterday, or the day before now, one of those cases successfully made it through a preliminary hearing, and a judge allowed the charges to go forward to trial. We've also been really proactive in response to the murder of George Floyd and advocating for reforms in policing around things like preventing the city from hiring police with a history of serious misconduct, around urging the California State Bar to prohibit as an ethical matter district attorneys and candidates for the office of district attorney from accepting political or financial contributions from police unions whose members we may have to make criminal charging decisions about. We've stopped relying on the testimony of officers with known documented histories of dishonesty or racial bias. We implemented a policy requiring our staff to review body-worn camera footage before filing charges like resisting arrest or assault on an officer, charges that we know historically have been used to cover up police misconduct or excesses. Now, again, if someone does assault an officer, of course we will prosecute that case. But if officers beat someone up and use that charge to cover up their misconduct, we refuse to be complicit. And we've taken other bold initiatives to shape police policy and to push back on the ways in which our office has been complicit in exacerbating mass incarceration over decades. We created a post-conviction review unit and an innocence commission so that we're not just doing justice looking forward, but also looking backwards. We've resentenced over 40 people who were in state prison. Just last week, an 85-year-old woman who'd been in prison since quite literally before some of the panelists here today were born, since the early 1980s, an 85-year-old woman. And we brought her home to her family and community. You know, I think at the end of the day, being a progressive prosecutor means looking at problems we see with public safety and with justice and addressing them at the root. In San Francisco, for example, about 75% of the people police arrest and bring to the county jail are drug addicted, mentally ill, or both. The county jail has become the number one provider of mental health services. It's inhumane, it's not cost efficient, and it's not effective at actually building safety. So we need to focus on public health approaches to these problems. We need to use arrests not as opportunities to punish and warehouse human beings, but rather to connect people with the kinds of services and supervision that will actually break the cycle of crime and violence in our communities. I'm happy to stop there to make space for others and look forward to questions. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. So Darcy Covert, of course, you are not a progressive prosecutor, but you have some very much want to hear your thoughts on what it's like to be a public defender in jurisdictions, you know, or at least what your thoughts are on being a public defender against, you know, progressive prosecutor measures and what impact that is.
Sure. So thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here today. Should start by saying, you know, as Marissa said, I'm a line public defender, the only person here whose name is not proverbially on the door. So I should say, you know, everything that I say today reflects my own views and not those of my employer. So I'm glad that we're starting out with this question, because before I am the wet blanket on this panel, I do want to be clear about kind of what exactly my argument is. And for that, I think it's kind of helpful to start with where I'm coming from. And I think my job kind of shapes how I think about progressive prosecution in two primary ways. The first is that, you know, I don't shape prosecutorial agendas, and as a result, my kind of first order views about criminal justice reform or what prosecutors should be doing are kind of not relevant. And that's really not where I'm coming from and not my argument. And second, you know, I come face to face every day with the damage that the criminal system does through my clients. And as a result, I really am cognizant that every step, no matter how small, of improvement really does make an impact at the individual level on people's lives. And there really is no question that a defendant being prosecuted by one of these offices is likely in a better position, maybe the same position, but really unlikely to be in a worse position than they would be, you know, if they're being prosecuted by an office run by a traditional prosecutor. I do think that goes both ways, though. And as a result, I am sort of personally not moved by arguments that progressive prosecutors have made incremental change, and therefore, you know, that is something, you know, that we should be satisfied with. And so as a result of these kind of two things, I'm most interested in evaluating progressive prosecutors, the progressive prosecutor agenda, on its own terms. What I mean by that is that I take the progressive prosecutor movement's goals as they are, in other words, what this movement envisions for itself, and ask whether, as currently framed, it's likely to achieve its objectives. And I do think it's important to say at the outset that not every progressive prosecutor, you know, views things the same way. And certainly people like Chesa, I really do think are meaningfully different than many others. But I do think that there's a lot of consistency, and that is really where I'm focused. And in thinking about that and whether, you know, that really is likely to achieve what this movement wants, in short, my answer is no. And I can kind of explain more the details about why that is later. But at a high level, you know, as you've heard about today, the progressive prosecutor movement sets its sights on big change, you know, really systemic change, reducing or eliminating mass incarceration, keeping individuals out of jails and prisons who are there simply because they're mentally ill, addicted to alcohol or drugs, or poor, making sure that innocent people are not convicted. For individuals who are guilty, making sure that they are sentenced proportionately and fairly, and reducing racial discrimination in the criminal system. And yet, I think we would all agree, and I think the progressive prosecutor movement is sort of premised on the idea that those are problems largely, although not entirely, created by prosecutors. But this movement also very much is premised on, and in fact embraces, prosecutorial power, and kind of fundamentally the idea that if you put good people in these offices, that they will use that power for good, and largely kind of to unilaterally, you know, make different decisions, kind of unilaterally dispense justice for defendants. And I am skeptical about that, largely because the policies, again, that we see at kind of the core of this movement and not necessarily at all the edges, involve deploying the power of the state in ways that we already know does not keep people out of jails and prisons, because these are not new ideas. And so instead, I think the prosecutors who are truly committed, you know, to making these really meaningful and substantive changes to the system should support the reduction of power and resources from their offices and building up power and resources elsewhere. And that involves things like limitations on prosecutorial power, but also, you know, supporting, for example, the revival of social services so that people are getting the resources they need in the community so that they are never coming into contact with the criminal system in the first place. So happy to, again, talk more about kind of the nuts and bolts later in the panel, but I will leave it there for now.
Terrific. Thank you. And I'm going to ask Miriam Krinsky from the Fair and Just Prosecution, of course, to kind of weigh in on this question as well.
So thanks, Marissa. And I also want to thank the organizers for setting the table for what is an incredibly timely conversation. And let me start by noting that, again, while my name doesn't sit on any door, Darcy, I do bring to this issue a decade and a half of experience as a prosecutor. And in many ways, because it was during the 80s and 90s and that heyday of the ramp up of tough on crime, the sorts of policies and practices that we now know were inherently failed, but that fueled mass incarceration, because I saw the damage that was done. So there are those who have seen the damage from the individual clients they represent. There are those who have seen the damage by being part of a system that we now know dramatically failed. People failed, families failed, communities. That very much led me to the view that we needed to do something different, that we needed to avoid wasting lives, wasting communities, and trying to stem the tide of what too often can become an intergenerational cycle that sucks people into the criminal legal system. So as I think about that label, and I want to echo Stephen's starting point, which is, in my mind, it really is not a helpful label. But as I think about those terms, progressive prosecutor, I think in many ways, and Chase had touched on this, it's both too limiting and too expansive. And let me define what I mean by that. I think it's easy to throw around those terms. And there are many who have self-labeled themselves in that way who really don't stand for what I think are some of the fundamentals. And I agree with much of Darcy's conceptualization of those fundamentals, of what we are striving for. But I also think that too often the terms are too limiting as well. It isn't about, as was referenced earlier, progressive versus conservative. It isn't about a side of the political fence that you sit upon. We know that the impetus for change is bipartisan. We know, and hopefully we'll get to Joseph's question later, that this is rural as well as urban. It's not limited to the big cities. This is a movement that is sweeping coast to coast and everywhere in between. And so when we look around, in my mind, what we have to be asking is not, and this perhaps touches on Claire's question, not who fits that label, but rather what are the standards, what are the principles that we're trying to lift up? And I would suggest, and as Chase and John know, we often like to try to push folks even further down the track. I would suggest that this is about being decarceral, but it's actually about more than that, because we believe it's about how do we think about moving away, not just from imprisonment and a carceral state, but how do we move away from punishment? How do we think about alternatives to punishment and alternatives to the criminal legal system so that we really find our place, ourselves in a place where we are shrinking the size of the criminal justice system? So our 21 principles, which was an effort by a collection of groups, including Fair and Just Prosecution, to try to think about what are the pillars of those standards, those principles we're looking to see advanced, is anchored by, those principles are anchored by two pillars. First, how do we shrink the footprint of the criminal legal system? And second of all, how do we increase accountability and fairness? So what do we want less of, and what do we want more of? In shrinking that footprint, it's acknowledging, as Jason mentioned earlier, that we should never be at a point where we have to bring people in, we have to incarcerate them before we can treat them. We have to invoke the criminal legal system before we can help people. It's about recognizing that our criminal legal system has gotten so large that its footprint has pushed out public health, social services, and so much more that people need. And if anything, if it could just get out of the way and leave space for others to fill, we would be so much better. But the starting point fundamentally has to be, we need a criminal legal system that does no harm. Ideally, we'd like to see it do positive things, but at least if it can shrink itself and get out of the way and do no harm, we would be in a better place. And second of all, how do we think about those elements of increasing accountability and fairness? Things like police accountability, obviously a very timely issue right now as we're starting that beginning of the George Floyd murder trial that all eyes of the nation will be watching. How do we look at new definitions of success that hopefully we can talk about later? How do we have elected prosecutors who can own past mistakes and not simply correct convictions, but also correct the injustices of past excessive sentences so that we can scroll back and look for a second chance for individuals who have been in custody for decades on end and pose no further danger to the community and can return and be valuable members of society? And finally, how do we recognize that, well, absolutely, John was right, we want safer communities, we also need healthier communities. And we can maybe over-police our way at times to safer communities, but those are not healthier communities. So how do we look for elected prosecutors who aren't just trying to be good people, hopefully, but they're trying to be good policymakers? They're trying to look for the elements of changing the system, systemic, fundamental change that can be long-lasting and can try to achieve the sort of North Star that I think Darcy's article and others have so aptly defined.
Thank you, everybody. I'm going to call a slight audible here because I want to make sure that we have enough time for Chesa to be able to participate in the conversation and kind of skip through what we had thought about covering, because I think you all did such a nice job of it, which is kind of where has the movement come from and, you know, where are we going, and really move into what accomplishments have we seen so far. And I'm going to actually open this a little bit broader than we had originally started, but I want to start with John. You've been on this kind of road since before it was cool, back in 2007, when you were first elected. What do you think that, at least from your perspective, as someone who self-identifies as a progressive prosecutor, what accomplishments have you seen accomplish in your own jurisdiction, and you kind of how does that flow out from, not necessarily as you as the centerpiece, but into other national conversations?
Yeah, so one of the fascinating things to be able to point at is some of the work I've done with Miriam and with Florida International University, Loyola University, of of actually doing deep dives on our data and going public with that. And one thing that we can demonstrate is that the approach we've taken has demonstrably impacted on reducing racial disparity. So that's a really significant thing. And in some really significant areas, we can show that there's almost no disparity, right? So that in itself is significant. But I agree, you know, I agree with so many of the points that have been made. And so it's not, you know, that's sort of, again, a measurement of what we do. It's not a measurement of the impact that it's having on the community. So one of the other things that I think has helped change the culture and the relationship of the DA's office with the community is actually changing the role of the prosecutor from being a line prosecutor who takes and reviews frozen moments in time and makes a decision based on that frozen moment in time of whether it meets elements and you move forward like that, and actually getting the prosecutors out of the courthouse and right into the community and giving them a broad mandate to help solve problems. How about that? Take the experience on the back end when everything's already gone to hell and the damage has been done. Take that experience and then go out into the community and start building team and neighborhood and community relationships so that the community actually helps inform where you put your priorities. They help direct where you're going to put resources. And your role is really to facilitate that and to use the skills and the access to resources and, yes, indeed, and access to power when that's needed. But it's done in collaboration with the community, and it starts changing how people view the prosecutors. The most successful thing that happens for me is when I'm in a community setting and somebody starts talking about one of their community prosecutors. Community prosecutor is a bad name for them. We're going to have to figure out a much better name. But the relationship has changed because they'll be talking to me as the DA almost with the sense that prosecutor that works with them is their prosecutor. It doesn't necessarily work for me. He or she works for them. And that's one fundamental way you can approach it. I also think that by meaningful collaborations with entities outside, both inside and outside the system. In other words, actually giving your public defenders and your defense bar an actual voice in setting policy and setting up processes where, for example, something as simple as make sure that they have all the information that you have right from the start, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like that big a stretch, but there's a lot of systems where the defense bar or the public defenders can't even make an assessment initially of what their client faces until they get the police report. So you can set up a system where you allow access and you start the process of assessing what people actually need, what kind of risk do they pose, what do they actually need, and then trying to divert them. The biggest challenge, I will tell you, and I don't disagree with anything Darcy's saying, the problem is the perennial question that every prosecutor faces who's committed to reforming this process is the question of divert to what? We have seen in the last year that there is nothing to divert to. We have failed atrociously as a country because we don't have a public health system. We have not prioritized that. We have not prioritized giving people safe, affordable housing. We've done the exact opposite, but we have not prioritized making our communities healthy. And so redefining the relationship of the prosecutor and allowing a prosecutor to do things besides just prosecute cases is actually very empowering. And I think it's going to attract a new generation of prosecutors who are not going to be enamored with, the classic law and order vision of, dramatic adversarial contests in court. That's my final point, is that we also have to move away from what we all do. Anybody that's been through law school is indoctrinated in the adversarial system, and we have to start moving away from that. There's a time and a place for it, both for public defenders, for defense attorneys, for prosecutors, for judges. There is an important role for the adversarial process, but we overemphasize it all the time. We just do. We think we can solve all the problems through impact litigation and through all these different things. And that hasn't proven to be true either. So that's my thought.
And I think, Darcy, since the public defender, you know, kind of bell was just rung on that, I think it's fair to kind of bring you into that part of the conversation as well. You know, and I just kind of wanted to follow that thread in terms of, like, we were talking about accomplishments of progressive prosecutors, but to what extent do you think that it is possible to bring public defenders into that conversation? Do public defenders even want to be a part of that conversation?
Sure. So, I mean, that's a good question. Admittedly, not one that I have thought much about. I think very much public defenders do want to be part of the conversation. And I would say, I think John and I, and probably myself and frankly many other people, are a little bit of a different view on this about whether the adversarial system is valuable in this place. Because I think very much my point is that, kind of echoing something that Miriam said, is that in many ways, I think prosecutors should be getting out of the way. And so we shouldn't be asking prosecutors to do more things or different things, but instead to, you know, for example, support, you know, reviving, you know, social services, which, as John pointed out, you know, has been just a massive, you know, public failure. But taking money out of prosecutors' budgets, you know, and as prosecutors supporting that so that those systems do exist and there is somewhere, you know, to divert people that's not court supervision. And to answer a little bit, you know, your kind of original question, Marissa, about kind of the accomplishments of this movement, I think that they've been mixed. And I should say, of course, like, I'm, you know, not the person in the best position to kind of answer this, because there's the data that's out there from these offices is pretty limited. But in thinking about, you know, this question as you had posed it to us when we were preparing, I did think about kind of one metric that we could think about, and that's jail populations and how they've changed during COVID. For those of you who don't know, the Vera Institute has been tracking this data. They have actually a really well done website where you can look at this for counties that do publish their jail data. As I said, I mean, the results, and again, you know, this is just one metric. I'm not saying that this is representative or anything, but the results are really mixed when you look at progressive prosecutors' jurisdictions. There are places where there have been huge improvements, and San Francisco is absolutely one of them. Jail population is down 26% during COVID. In Wynedote, where Mark Dupree is a prosecutor, down 13%. Jefferson County, which just elected Alexis King, the jail population is down 33%. And then you can move to some jurisdictions that have really prominent progressive prosecutors where the jail population is basically unchanged, like Cook County with Kim Fox, and Larimer County, and then Philadelphia, where Larry Krasner is. And then you move even further to jurisdictions where actually the jail population is up, such as in New York City, where you know, there's not one but two progressive prosecutors, and in Orange County, Florida, where you've had successive progressive prosecutors, and the jail population is up 10%. So, you know, I'm not saying that this is conclusive. I'm just saying, you know, to me, I think this demonstrates that it's not enough just to be kind of abstractly committed to reducing the jail population. And, you know, Miriam's organization put out a letter signed by many progressive prosecutors about a year ago, committing to reducing jail populations during COVID. And I think that this may suggest that really the difference is not kind of, are you committed to the core progressive prosecutor platform, but are you committed to going further than that, as some of the prosecutors in some of these jurisdictions have been.
And it's kind of looping back through that, Chase said, you know, obviously San Francisco was just mentioned as a model for reducing the jail population with that. So you've been in office for now a little over a year, being able to see what kind of, how have you seen your ability to make that change that you wanted to see as a public defender and as a candidate, as the head elected prosecutor for your jurisdiction? How have you been able to see those accomplishments in real life?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess there's a lot to respond to. Let me share, if I can, I'm trying to get it, a report that's really topical in response to some of the points Darcy was making, that we put out, kind of looking at how we had reduced the jail population. And I didn't hear the percentage Darcy said. I guess it was taken from the Vera Institute, but I think it's pretty far off the actual numbers. And maybe that's just a question of, you know, what their starting point was and what their ending point was. That's the nature of statistics. But when I took office in January of 2020, our jail population peaked that month around 1,250 human beings in the jail. And at its trough, in kind of late spring, early summer during the pandemic, we got below 700. We've stabilized in the high 700s. We're currently around 775. So, you know, depending on how you measure it, it's much more like a 40% drop. But I think one of the other things that's important to think about, you know, particularly as I hear some of the criticisms of folks like Larry Krasner and Kim Fox and others who are colleagues of ours, is to remember that, you know, as much as people like to emphasize the tremendous power that prosecutors have, and we do, we don't operate in a vacuum. And one of the things that drives the jail population far more than any decision that I make is police practices. How many people are being brought to the jail every day? And court practices. How quickly are the judges releasing people? We have some cases where we ask for people to be released and the court disagrees and sets bail, even though we object as a matter of policy to any use of money bail. Right? That's a policy I put in place my first week in office. We will not ever sit by and watch the court use wealth as a proxy for incarceration. And yet the court does it sometimes. And similarly, there are cases where we ask the court to detain someone because we believe they are a public safety risk that can't be mitigated by non-monetary conditions, and the court may disagree and not release people. So, you know, we as much as folks like to focus on prosecutors as a uniquely powerful entity within the broader criminal legal system, it's also true, as in every other area of government life, that there are checks and balances on our power. And I think that also dovetails with a point that Darcy makes in her article, you know, and something that, frankly, I didn't fully appreciate myself when I was a public defender for many years, until, you know, I had to actually start dealing with the budget process as a department head. But I would love if all of the money that is going into the war on drugs instead went into a public health approach to battling addiction. But I don't control the budget. In fact, I don't have any control over the budget. The mayor and the board of supervisors control the budget in San Francisco and in most jurisdictions. And so it's not as simple as saying, well, we'll give up resources or get out of the way, as one of the panelists said, and then we get to control where the resources go. The problem is we are dealing with a world in which if I get out of the way and stop prosecuting the drug cases that I know are ineffective as a response to the really serious challenges we have with overdose fatalities and with addiction, then what happens as a practical matter is not that that money gets given to public health services or harm reduction or safe consumption sites. As a practical matter, the U.S. attorney starts prosecuting people for the same exact cases. And the U.S. attorney cooperates with ICE, and those people get deported, which they wouldn't if I were the one prosecuting them. And those people don't get access to drug treatment programs or our drug court, which they will if I'm the one prosecuting people who have substance use disorders. So it is a much more complicated terrain when you're in this seat than I think in an idealistic world it would be from the outside. And I have defense attorneys who practice in federal court in some cases calling me and begging me not to stop prosecuting drug cases. And it seems counterintuitive when you're in the standpoint of a public defender. When I was a public defender for many years, wouldn't have anticipated that. But when the alternative is a Trump administration U.S. attorney doing drug sweeps in poor neighborhoods and detaining people pre-trial and then handing them over to ICE, that's a really, really stark alternative. It's a dire one for the people. And it's not that my office prosecuting them is somehow good or benevolent. No one wants to be prosecuted, of course. But the alternative isn't this sort of idealized, well, I can give up my budget and then we'll have you know, all the public health programming that John mentioned, you know, this country is systematically underfunded. The alternative is often something far worse. And so I think the work of public defenders and of criminal justice reform advocates and of progressive prosecutors is to build those alternatives. But we're flying an airplane and we're trying to build an alternative in midair. And so getting out of the way when you're dealing with, for example, people who repeatedly commit acts of violence against vulnerable elders, getting out of the way is complicated. You know, we don't need to think that jail or prison is a good solution. But until we have a good solution, I'm not going to simply say, well, because I don't like jail and prison, I'm going to stand by and watch while people who engage in repeated acts of violence continue to do that. We can't. That's not our job. That's not what we're elected to do. It's not the role that we have to play when it comes to public safety. And I appreciate when public defenders do get engaged and say, hey, this is based on trauma, and this is based on a history of mental illness, and this is based on you know, someone being unhoused, and all those things that are really important context that as prosecutors, we don't have the luxury of necessarily knowing without collaborative and sometimes adversarial public defenders giving us that information. That information informs the decisions we make. But until we have, not necessarily from us, but until we as a society have effective ways to respond to violence in particular, we need to figure out how we can intervene in ways that minimize harm, but also engage people who feel under attack, who feel that they are unsafe in their own neighborhoods, their own homes, their own communities, and that make clear that there are consequences and there is accountability when you cause harm in the community. What that accountability looks like, I think, as Danielle Surrett writes really eloquently about, you know, in her book, that accountability should be and must be more complicated than simply punishment. And I think one of the fundamental problems with how so many in the media and in the public think about and understand criminal justice, how they understand accountability, is as narrowly defined as punishment. And the more we punish people, the more we're holding them accountable. But that's not true, right? Danielle Surrett explains, I think, it's something I saw through my parents' decades in prison. My father's pushing on closing his fourth decade in prison now. He's been in for 39 years. And as difficult as that length of incarceration is, as difficult as any period of incarceration is, it's possible to simply and passively accept it. What's harder, what's more challenging, what's more transformative is being held accountable in ways that directly engage with the people whose lives the crime harmed. And so when one of the victims of my father's crime went to visit him in his prison, when he came face to face with her and understood from seeing her humanity and hearing her story the harm that his crime caused, it did more for his understanding and for his compassion and for his remorse than any number of decades in a cage could do. And our system is sadly really devoid of that kind of meaningful accountability, of that kind of transformative justice. So I think we need more of it, and we need people in our communities, the people who elect us and reelect us, hopefully, to appreciate that restorative justice can be far more powerful of a tool to hold folks who've caused harm accountable, and far more effective of a tool to uplift and heal victims who've been harmed than simply imposing arbitrary numbers of years of punishment.
All right, you've been listening to Can Progressive Prosecutors Make a Difference? From the Crime Report, Guggenheim Symposium of March of 2021, hosted by Marissa Bluestein of Center for Fair Administration of Justice, featuring John Chisholm, District Attorney of Milwaukee, Miriam Krinsky from Fair and Just Prosecution, Public Defender Darcy Calvert, and San Francisco District Attorney Chasia Bowden. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media. KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kpw.org.
We'll be right back.